Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. If you stepped outside any time in the last decade or more in neighborhoods like Chelsea, the East Village, and Harlem, you've noticed the spruced-up homes and the influence of the influx of affluent white heterosexual families. In her new book, The Gentrification of the Mind, Witnessed to a Lost Imagination, author Sarah Schulman argues that it's not simply the usual factors we think of, the allure of a city with lower crime, more jobs, and better schools, but the deaths of some 85,000 New Yorkers from AIDS that made this gentrification possible. And she argues, along with physical gentrification, there's been a gentrification of the mind. Joining us this morning is Sarah Schulman. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thank you, Andrea.
Now, before we go on, I just wanted to put out a call to people who lived in New York in the 1980s, who lived through the AIDS crisis, 70s, 80s. Give us a call. I'd like to hear from you about your personal stories about New York in those days, differences, bad and good, between those times and now. 212-433-9692 is the phone number. 212-433-WNYC. Now, Sarah, what do you mean by the title of your book, Gentrification of the Mind?
Well, gentrification has changed the way we think because we now have a homogenous city. And urbanity depends on difference, that different kinds of people are interacting with each other and acknowledge each other's realities. That's what produces new ideas for the culture, whether it's revolutionary political movements or new art ideas. And when you homogenize a city, you kill its urbanity. You make it less likely that, new thinking can be produced.
Is New York really homogenous as a whole city, or is it just certain, you know, neighborhoods in Manhattan that have become very difficult to live in if you don't have a lot of means?
New York is now profoundly segregated. There is a white bourgeois culture that has inhabited most of Manhattan and parts of Brooklyn, and in which you have to be wealthy to enter into. There are still people who were there from before who are holdovers, but for the most part, they're closed. And then there's neighborhoods that are filled with new immigrants who are attending different kinds of schools, who are acting, who are living in different environments. And there's like a private sector and public sector. And very often the two do not meet.
You offer a pretty chilling set of parallels in your book. You notice that the neighborhoods where the most gentrification has occurred, neighborhoods like Chelsea, West Village, Lower East Side, Harlem, are some of the ones that had the most AIDS deaths, which is sort of really chilling when you think about it. But how do we know that, you know, one led to the next?
Well, it's also nationally. If you look, New York and San Francisco are two of the most gentrified cities in the United States. And, of course, they had the highest AIDS rates. It's because gentrification started in the 1970s. Just to give a little background, after World War II, there was the GI Bill, and this enabled a lot of ethnic whites to leave the city and move to the suburbs and start to live in privatized living. And a lot of these new housing developments were racist. They excluded black people. So there was a lot of white people leaving the city. And this was called white flight. This was the time in which I grew up in New York. So New York at that time was an open city. Rents were very cheap. I know you hear stories about people getting 3 months free rent for signing a lease, this sort of thing. And it was much more open culturally, much less controlled. Gentrification was official policy. It starts in the 70s, and you start to see this. They no longer building low-income housing. They start to give enormous tax breaks to luxury developers, and you start to see condo conversion, and you start to see abandoned buildings being turned into luxury housing and people being evicted, this sort of thing. Operation Pressure Point, increased police pressure, and this profound change so that people who grew up in the suburbs, the children of the GI Bill, who grew up in racially stratified communities could move back into the city and, quote, feel safe. Now, this question of what makes, is the city getting better or worse? Well, if you're someone who needs to have a controlled environment to feel safe, it's getting better. But it actually made it dangerous for the people who were already living here, many of whom lost control of their neighborhoods.
But, I mean, didn't the city needed to get some people of means back because there was no tax base to support anything.
Well, that's the excuse that was given. I mean, the argument at the time was that we need to bring back rich people so that we can expand our tax base so that we can have all these great services. But here we are today in 2012. The city is overflowing with rich people. And we have horrible mass transit. The schools are completely underfunded. We're losing our hospitals. So this tax base has not, this expansion of rich people has not contributed to the city.
Well, the subways in the late 1970s and the 1980s, I mean, the system is far from perfect, but they were worse then. I've read the Strapphanger's report, the state of the subways from the early 1980s, and something like a quarter of train cars had doors that opened during each ride. Almost none of them had, lighting in them.
Well, I know that my bus line, for example, no longer runs on weekends or evenings. So there's been a lot of slashing of things that working people use.
All right, we have a lot of people calling in, to sort of talk about this. Let's take some calls from some people who sort of lived through this era. About this question about whether New York City has become a less creative, more sterile place since the 1980s. Let's go to Russell from the West Village. Hi, Russell. You're on WNYC.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Did you have something you wanted to say? You're on the air.
I live in the West Village now. I have lived here since 1979. I am currently living with HIV. I've lost two partners in the past and have returned now and am in the middle of the West Village housing environment. So it's all very relevant to my current situation, what you're talking about.
And Russell, do you feel that the city has sort of lost something, a certain sort of je ne sais quoi by becoming a, whiter, more affluent and, more segregated place?
Absolutely. Being white, professional myself, we've lost a lot of the old Greenwich Village atmosphere in my neighborhood now. The new West Village is not what it was at all.
All right, Russell, thank you so much for your call. Let's take another call. Let's go right to Lewis from Manhattan. Hi, Lewis. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I watch the show. I listen to the show all the time. I'm born and raised here. I'm in my 40s. I'm from Brooklyn, the Bensonhurst, Dyke Heights area, although, I'm a homeowner. I come from the slope. I mean, keeping it in Brooklyn, I think this word, gentrification, I don't know where it came from. I don't know the origins of it, but the definitions that I hear of it, I feel it's a good thing. I mean, you got a lot of wonderful professional people coming in, and unfortunately, over the years, I mean, people find this into race, and that's a very liberal attitude to take as far as I'm concerned. It's a big influx of professional people coming in. Unfortunately, a lot of people out here make decisions. I mean, they made poor decisions in their lives. They didn't go to school. They didn't do the right thing. That's their business. I mean, people that went to school, did what they had to do, and now are enjoying the fruits of their labor. They should not have to pay the price, and be called and be labeled gentrifiers.
All right, Lewis,
you get my drift?
There's a lot of ideas there. Let's get a response from Sarah Shulman. Sarah Shulman?
Well, a city relies on new ideas coming in. And right now, if you're a young artist, let's say, or you cannot move to New York City, it is impossible. You can't pay the rent. You can't find space to work in. They spend all their time working multiple jobs. It's impossible. It's like we're closing the doors to young creative voices. And that is against the spirit of the city, the history of the city, and what has always made New York City great.
And yeah, it does. I mean, one of the things I think that, we saw in the sort of whole Occupy Wall Street movement is that somehow people seem to be figuring it out. I mean, it does seem impossible to move to New York as a young creative person, and yet people are living in Bushwick or, in Bed-Stuy, and they do seem to be somehow entering, despite all the odds.
Well, I mean, Occupy Wall Street is one of the best things that's happened in years, and it's very exciting to see people rethinking the box. But that doesn't mean that this is a city that welcomes change and diversity. At this point, it does not.
Let's take another call. Sean from Manhattan. Hi, Sean. You're on WNYC. Sean, you there?
Yes.
Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hello, how are you? I do listen to your program, and it's wonderful. Initially, when you started this conversation, you mentioned the AIDS epidemic and that gentrification was being built on the facts of that. Now the conversation is broadened because I found that thesis very flawed, considering that I am actually a survivor of the HIV epidemic, and I am HIV positive. And I live on the Upper West Side, where you can't get more gentrified than that. But we were gentrifying up here in the 80s, before the AIDS epidemic. They were called yuppies.
Yeah, let me explain the relationship. So gentrification starts in the late 70s, and you start to see a lot of city policy going towards luxury development. And totally by coincidence, it's not a conspiracy, but the AIDS crisis begins in 81. So you have some, in key neighborhoods, you have a very high rate of mass death in key neighborhoods just at the moment the gentrification policies are in place. And what is particularly sad about that was that in those days, there were no partner rights. So if a person died of AIDS, their partner was not able to inherit the lease. So every leaseholder who died of AIDS meant that an apartment went to market rate. And this created an unnatural rate of change, of huge numbers of apartments in key areas going to market rate. And when you look today, those are the most gentrified neighborhoods in New York.
Sean, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, I did. I absolutely agree. I took some friends who used to live in New York on a tour of the West Village, and they said, what happened to all the gay people? And I said, they died. My point is that was a piece of the puzzle. But gentrification has happened because this city has been transformed by our industry, the real estate industry. We don't make shirts here anymore. The current mayor started with Giuliani, and this mayor brought it very head. The New Yorker we want to sustain this tax base that they want is the professional person. In my neighborhood, when you go to buy a condominium, the first question on the form is, what is the name of your firm? It's not, are you planning to write a novel or start a theater group? Like, I came here in the 80s for those things. That, they're not wanted here anymore, and your guest is absolutely right in saying that. That person is not supposed to be in New York now. This is a different New York. Like it or hate it, this is what we have. And yes, it is homogenous. It is all these things. And I don't see how you're going to turn back the clock.
All right. Thank you for your call, Sean. Let's take another call. We're getting a lot of calls on this. Let's go to Tim from the East Village. Hi, Tim. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I was in San Francisco in 1979, and I was the only straight worker on a construction crew. Everybody else that was on that crew is dead from AIDS. However, the thing about what was transpiring in San Francisco, and I presume it was happening in New York, was that in those presumed dangerous neighborhoods, basically the premise was you bought the worst house on the block, the house that was ignored in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, and had all of those beautiful details that, you know, it wasn't modernized, and that we're now replacing again. We're trying, you know. And it was gay people that were moving in because they could see this old quality, and they didn't have to worry about their children in the schools. They didn't have to worry about their partner being attacked or their wife being attacked on the street because they were ex-wrestlers and football quarterbacks. I mean, these were not fey guys. These were really ex-military. I mean, it was and so, yes, they did die from AIDS. But the thing was is that they would buy these houses. Their friends would come, their straight breeder friends would come visit them, and they would say, gee, this isn't as dangerous a neighborhood as I thought. This is a nicer environment. It's a beautiful space. It's less money than I'm paying in the suburbs. It's more convenient. And I'm going to move in here. And then they start having children. But to say that the AIDS epidemic was the premise of why all of this happened, now, was it a sadness? You bet. But to build this as the premise of why this happened, if this was a social event that was happening already, that people that were accepting of gay people that weren't gay were socialized with them. I mean, if the
government
Tim,
was... Tim, yeah. Hang on. Let's get a response, okay?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much,
yes,
Tim, for your call.
Gentrification, like I said, was already ongoing before the AIDS crisis began, but the AIDS crisis contributed to it because it created a lot of empty apartments at key moments in certain neighborhoods. But I just want to say that gentrification was not caused by individuals. Gentrification was the process of city policy. There was substantive tax breaks to luxury developers, and there was a moratorium on building low-income housing. And that's not caused by a gay guy going in and fixing an apartment.
But, I mean, this issue of the tax base, I mean, the city really was falling apart in the 1970s, broke. So,
yeah, but Andrea, I teach in the City University of New York, okay? I have 38 kids in a writing workshop. We have a room with exposed lights, large ventilation. There's no smart rooms. The kids don't have computers. They can't afford the tuition. There's no paper. I mean, that's the City University. So where's the tax money that's supposed to be coming from all these rich people?
Well, what would it have been like without it? Would it have been the same? What is the answer to that? Where is the money going?
Well, the money is not going to the public sector. That is for sure. Okay, the money is not going to public education. It is not going to mass transit. It is not going to city hospitals. It's not. And you know that very well.
All right, let's take calls. Yeah. Veronica from Brooklyn. Hi, Veronica. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm born and raised in New York, and I'm in my 40s now. And I definitely remember I grew up between the Upper West Side, the South Bronx, and later Brooklyn. And I now have moved back to my childhood Brooklyn neighborhood, which is Clinton Hill, which is one of the big, like, totally gentrified, just completely different than what it was like when I was young. But I do think that the city is really boring. Like, I'm constantly on the verge of leaving. I do think it has to do with an influx of cash. And I liked a lot about what you said about where a lot of the people who are coming here, and I don't think it's really even a matter of race, but just the neighborhoods they grew up in and what they were coming from. I think that a lot of those suburban neighborhoods that I know that the people in these neighborhoods now who are coming to New York came from were really bereft of both culture and difference and certainly not edginess. And they moved to New York to try to get an edginess, but a place doesn't give you an edginess. You have to come with it. You have the creative energy that was here in New York. It used to be the people who were sort of on the outside of their communities moved to New York because they didn't feel accepted in a status quo. I mean, that's why both my parents came from other parts. You know, they were jazz musician and an artist, retrospectively. So when they got here, it was like, great, we can do these things. And their relatives certainly thought, you're odd, and of course you belong there. Where now it's like, oh, you come and just do your time in New York, and that will make you kind of cool and interesting. And it doesn't, but I was just saying that for me, it's also a bit of a national issue. I think this whole generation and people kind of in their 30s and under, I'm sorry, but they're boring. And I don't know why, but I think it has to do with the nationalization of things like MTV, because all of a sudden everyone can kind of see this formulaic way of here's what you do, here's what you wear, here's how you act, and that's going to make you interesting, rather than just sort of coming up with things organically within themselves. So the fact that when I was young, if I used to go see friends in New Jersey, they were really cool in a totally different way. The girls feathered their hair, they listened to different music, but it was almost like a different culture from state to state. I don't think you see that anywhere, so I think you can even pull back. Everything you're saying is really interesting, but nationally there's almost a problem of, like, we're not such an interesting society anymore because people are really force-fed this prepackaged notion
of
creativity. That's all I wanted
Thanks
to say.
For your call, Veronica.
Yeah, you're raising some really important issues. Before suburbs, people came to New York to become New Yorkers. They came here because they wanted to escape their backgrounds. They wanted to get away from religion and their families. They wanted to have sex. They wanted to make art. They wanted to make money. They wanted to have adventures. After suburbanization, a different type of person was produced, a person who was used to very racially stratified, class stratified culture, car culture, where there's a lot of conformity of food and conformity of cultural influence. And these are people who were willing to trade freedom for security. And they came to New York to change New York. I mean, it's interesting. Penny Arcade, who's an iconic New York artist, says that when she moved here, she never felt the need to open a cute cafe or a little boutique. She came to live here as the people did themselves. But there's a supremacy ideology at play about the homogenized suburban mentality. And it's a kind of colonial attitude towards New York. And that's what was brought here. And that's what we're facing now, that the influence of that. It's not, and there's no self-awareness. In terms of how to de-gentrify, you know, it's about having awareness about these kinds of ideologies, these sort of attitudes, and a recognition that being uncomfortable and living with difference actually is beneficial in life, and you don't need to smooth everything over.
We have to wrap up, but is there something that you think that the government should do to sort of make it easier for the creative class to live in New York, for young people to move here?
Yes, we should end all the wars, and we should build low-income housing for all.
All right.
Thank you.
And on that note, thank you so much, Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. My guest has been Sarah Schulman. Her new book is The Gentrification of the Mind, Witness to a Lost Imagination. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back with a talk about kids and cooking. Parents out there, do you make your kids cook? By which I mean your teenagers, your 10-year-old. Well, we would like to hear from you in the last part of the show, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you're a kid, if you're a parent or a teacher, call us up. We'd like to know, do you cook? What do you cook? And how does it all work out?